if you look at every rate hiking cycle in the US going back into the 1960s, and there's nine of them, you see that the average length between the initial rate hike and the onset of a recession is actually something like 27 months. And so we're not even at 27 months yet. And even there was one outlier there that was like 50 months. If you take that one out, and you know, I'm not a fan of playing with statistics, but if you take that one out, it's still 22 months. So we're only just at 22 months. So for people to say that, well, we haven't had a recession yet, so therefore we've escaped one, I think is not looking at history properly.
Hello and welcome back to SOAR Financially, where we discuss the macro to understand the micro. My name is Kai Hoff, and I'm the JR Mining Guy on Twitter and the CEO of the SOAR Financial Group. Really appreciate you joining us here for another lively discussion. I've just had the pleasure of chatting with Adrian Day before hitting the record button, and we've got some fantastic topics lined up to go through. We'll start on the macro level, but then we'll work our way through to the mining stocks, the micro, as we call it. So we'll set the scene first, then we'll talk sentiment. And Adrian's went through the earnings of some of the majors, and I'm curious what kind of trends and kind of signals he's picked up there as well, because I have yet to do that. I've yet to do my homework on the major mining stocks. I need to yet to find a good research report that sort of summarizes the earnings for me, because I'm too lazy to do my own homework. I'd rather have the analysts do it for me, and I just look at a table. So let me bring my guest on, though. But before I do that, there's a subscribe button down there somewhere. We truly appreciate it if you were to click on that and also leave a like. Do you like our guests? Do you like the questions that we ask? And if you don't, put the questions in the comment that you want us to ask. Really appreciate that. And now, Adrian, it's my pleasure to welcome you back here on SOAR Financially. It's good to see you again.
Well, and you, Kai, thank you very much for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah, Adrian, we last spoke early November in New Orleans, so it's a good time to catch up. Quite a bit has happened, and a lot of water has flown float down the Mississippi River, and lots to catch up on, of course. So, but as mentioned, let's start on a very high macro level. Let's talk about the state of the economy. What has changed maybe in the last 3 months, and how confident are you about the markets right now?
Yeah, well, good questions. I mean, I don't think my views have really changed that much. I still think the U.S. in particular, but also Europe, Britain, and other economies are heading towards a recession. A recession, in fact, Britain's already in a recession, but a recession in the United States, in my view, is all but inevitable. I mean, nothing in this world is inevitable, I guess in taxes and death, but it's all but inevitable. And, you know, I think we're on track, basically. If you look at every recession, I mean, sorry, if you look at every rate hiking cycle in the US going back into the 1960s, and there's nine of them, you see that the average length between the initial rate hike and the onset of a recession is actually something like 27 months. And so we're not even at 27 months yet. And even there was one outlier there that was like 50 months. If you take that one out, and you know, I'm not a fan of playing with statistics, but if you take that one out, it's still 22 months. So we're only just at 22 months. So for people to say that, well, we haven't had a recession yet, so therefore we've escaped one, I think is not looking at history properly. So I think we're still on track for a recession in the United States. And if you look at some of the things that happened this month, for example, you know, continuing claims are up 1.9 million. Initial claims are up by a lot in January, 2,000 to 2,000 to 2,000 to 2,000 to 15,000. That's a big jump in January. Manufacturing, every single section of the country except Philadelphia region was down. You know, pending home sales down 5%, or almost 5% month on month. We're now back on pending home sales virtually to what they were at the depth of the COVID lockdown period. So there's a lot going on, and even the things that look positive, such as consumer spending. People talk about consumer spending, but if you look at the PCE report that came out today, you see that spending is easing. It's down in January for the first time in 5 months. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of indicators that are saying the economy is slowing. And again, my main point would be that the aggressive rate hiking cycle, in my view, is leading to a recession. It just takes time. You know, as for the market, you know, I'm a fundamentalist and a value investor. So this has not exactly been a good period for me. One thing I'll emphasize, which is important, when you're a value investor and you say this stock, this market is overvalued, and there's no question that on a historical basis, this is overvalued, you're not making a call that the market's going to crash and burn next week or next month. You're simply saying that you're really having a look at how much risk there is in the market. So this market could go on for a while, but I honestly think we're getting to the point, and there's indications in some of the Magnificent Seven that have been stumbling a little bit lately. I think we're reaching the end of this particular leg. I'm not calling for a big crash or anything like that, but I think in the near term, but I think we're going to see a rotation out of the stocks that have been leading. So it just doesn't seem that much more that when a company like Nvidia comes out, they obviously shot up on their earnings. But some of the companies are coming out with reasonably good news and the stocks aren't moving, which means we've sort of run out of buyers.
No, fantastic. Really, really good insights, Adrian. I made a lot of notes to things to follow up on. But the number one question that's burning under my fingernails right now, what would make you a bear, a general market bear, I'd call it, to turn into a bull? Because just looking out, like what would, because we always talk about the doom and gloom and something breaking, but I'm curious, like what kind of factors would actually make you think, okay, oh, maybe I was wrong on that recession call. I'm just curious, like I'm just fishing for maybe a different perspective on
things. Yeah. No, absolutely. No, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, if we saw evidence that the economy was actually getting better, was improving, as opposed to slowly deteriorating, if we saw evidence that the consumer continued spending, but was able to cut credit card debt and other debt, if we saw debt levels come down, so in other words, if we had a fundamentally strong economy, not an artificially strong economy, that would certainly change my mind. And frankly, if we saw the, you know, inflation numbers come down, you know, more than they have. So, I mean, a very low inflation and low debt levels coming back down, that would change my mind. It would not make me want to buy Nvidia or Apple, but it might make me want to invest in the broad stock market more than we are at the moment.
Yeah, it's like talks of a U.S. trampoline economy and maybe even a Goldilocks economy, like is seemingly omnipresent. And a lot of bears, especially on financial main media here, are turning bullish all of a sudden. It's like, oh, this is going to continue forever now again. Right. And especially with a looming rate cut scenario there as well.
Well, the narrative, contrary, of course, when bears turn bullish, that's normally the sign of a top. I mean, I know that from my business over 40 years, when people who sort of hung on and then I get a call that says, let's say gold going down, hey, Adrian, I just can't take it anymore. You know, I've held on. I just can't take it anymore. I want to sell all my gold stocks today. That's normally a bottom. And the same with the stock market. When bears turn to bulls, you know, you're close to a top.
No, it's what it feels like. Absolutely. I just interviewed somebody like an hour before you came on as well. And a really good question, like I'm going to ask you the same one. If you were to give the Fed and Jerome Powell a school grade, what would it be?
That's an interesting question. Well, okay, if you're asking me what grade would I give them since March of 2022, it would not be an A, but it would probably be a B. But if you ask me what grade I would give Powell since he became Fed chairman, it would be an F. And if you ask me what grade I would give the last four Fed chairmen, going back to Alan Greenspan, that would be a double F. Because whatever good the Fed is doing now, let's not forget, they got us into this problem in the first place with their excessively easy money, their ultra low interest rates, and keeping the easy money policy going for far too long. We can argue whether what they did in 2008 was necessary. I honestly don't think it was. But let's just say that putting $1 trillion into the economy and slashing rates was necessary then. Why on earth did we keep rates at, why did we continue to lower rates and keep rates ultra low until COVID came along? There was no reason for that. Absolutely no reason. So the Fed got us into this problem. I do think Jerome Powell has done a reasonably good job, as I say, in the last year. Listening to his last press conference after the January Fed meeting, I sort of found myself difficult to disagree with a word he said. But you know, that's a bit like a reformed alcoholic, if you like. So yeah. I'm, as you know, fundamentally, I'm not a fan of the Fed. I think the whole concept of a Federal Reserve, the whole concept of eight people sitting around a table in Washington, D.C., and deciding on what the most important price in the economy should be, which is what they're doing. They're price fixing. They are price fixing the most important price in the economy, the price of money. To think that those people can have all the information, they can read all the reports they want, but they don't know how people will react to this or that change. Nobody does. It's Soviet economic planning. And it doesn't work. But But anyway, I think Powell's done a reasonably good job in the last several months.
Trying to make the bridge now to gold and mining stocks and for the second part of our conversation here. But like, how important is the Fed to the gold price, for example, and the moves by the Fed? Like, what's the correlation? How strong is that? Because
Very strong. Very strong. I mean, if you go back and look at the last, you know, five or six times that the Fed has started cutting after increasing, that is precisely when gold takes off. This time's a little bit different, of course. We can talk about that. I mean, everybody knows it's because of central bank buying. So gold's move in the last 18 months has not been based on monetary factors. It's been based on central bank buying because of the weaponization of the dollar. So this has been a little bit different. But no, if you look back for the last, five times that the Fed has started cutting rates after raising them, that's when gold takes off. And you know, that's logical when you think about it. So I'm saying gold assets, let's say gold assets. So that includes the gold stocks. It includes silver. The gold assets will take off when the Fed starts to ease, and if they start to ease before they've killed inflation, that's the dramatic move for gold. That'll be the dramatic move for gold. And I don't think that they've killed inflation. Today's PCE suggests that they haven't. I don't think they've killed inflation at all. You know, you look at this PCE core, which is a relevant index for all those people that sleep on the streets and don't eat or heat. The PCE core is up 2.8% year on year. That's certainly lower than it was, right? Still 40% above the Fed's target. So we're not at the target yet. You look month on month and it's 0.4. So it's running at a 4.8% annual rate on the last month. So inflation is actually beginning to go in the wrong direction. And I think that's going to continue. I'm not one of these people looking for hyperinflation anytime soon or anything like that. But I think inflation is going to be stubborn. And I suspect over the next several months, certainly April, May, June, July, we're going to start seeing the inflation numbers pick up a little bit. They're going to pick up because the year-on-year comparisons are worse. Remember, we've just gone through four or five months when the year-on-year comparisons were kind of easy. Now they're going to start getting more difficult. That's number one. Number two is oil. The oil price, as you know, in the last, 4 months has gone up from 70 to 78. And the price of oil feeds through into the price of all goods in the stores. Every good in the store has to be transported, even if it's only, 5 miles from the local farm. And how much produce in stores these days come from the local farm? So it all has to be transported. And so it runs into the cost of goods in the stores. And if you listen to various consumer goods companies, I was on the Nestle call last week. Nestle is certainly saying the inflation rate generally is moderated, but things they're concerned with, like cocoa, coffee, and sugar, are going up. And they're saying we have not yet passed through to consumers the price increases that we had last year, so we're going to have to continue to pass through price increases to consumers this coming year, even if the inflation numbers come down a bit. And that's true of a lot of companies. And then the third thing is a little esoteric, but I don't know if you noticed in December. In December, when the CPI numbers, the PCE numbers came down, the one factor that was the largest, accounted for the largest decline, was health insurance. And the government, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, somehow determined that health insurance went down by over 30%. I don't know year on year. I don't know a single person anywhere in the country whose health insurance went down 30%. And so they're having to, and they're already doing it, they're having to kind of make adjustments and correct for that. So that's going to have an impact on the numbers that we see going forward. So I suspect inflation is going to remain certainly above. I think the 2.8% that we got year on year is going to be close to the low, and it'll probably pick up more towards the 3.5 to 4%.
Gotcha. To put a bow around that macro discussion and the Fed discussion, is do you expect the Fed to actually raise rates one more time, or are they done? Based on what you're saying, you wouldn't be surprised by another rate hike.
I don't think they're going to raise rates again, frankly. I think they missed their opportunity. Their opportunity to do that was in either September, when they'd already had a pause for a couple of months. 1 month because of August, they don't meet, but they'd already had 2 months without rate hikes. It was either September or it was December. But I don't think they're going to now, particularly as we get closer to an election. The Fed and Powell, they can talk all they like about the Fed being politically independent. But the plain fact is they may well be, even if they're politically independent, they don't want to give the impression that they're not. Raising rates close to the election would give a bad signal, frankly.
Isn't he supposed to be apolitical?
Well, I mean, that's another discussion. We can go there. I'm, as you probably noticed with my English understatement, I'm sort of allowing them that they're non-political.
No, let's not go down that rabbit hole. That's a discussion for another day, and we might have to share a pint and just discuss that over a pint there, Adrian, next time we see each other in person. Yeah. We opened the can of worms on gold, and I want to go down that rabbit hole with you now and the gold price discussion in general. Since we last talked, we're about $70 higher since the end of October, early November. Question is, what drove prices higher? You mentioned central bank buying, of course. So I'm curious, what other factors might be influencing it as well? And how much is geopolitics part of that price equation?
I think it is almost entirely central bank buying. If you look at other areas, you look at the gold ETFs. The gold ETFs have seen net outflows for the last 18 months, not every single week, not every single month, but the majority of weeks and the majority of months. You look at ETFs this year, you've had net outflows from gold ETFs every single week this year. In fact, we've now had, as of February 15th, which is the last numbers I saw for all of the global ETFs, we've had 44 tons move out of global gold ETFs, which is more than all of last year. So whoever are buyers of ETFs are not bullish on gold. They are not buying gold for monetary reasons, for geopolitical reasons, or for any other reason. If you look at coin sales, which is a good indicator of retail, they're down. The premiums are way down as well. So there's not a vibrant gold, there's not a vibrant coin business, coin market at the moment. So the retail people are not rushing out to buy gold because of Israel and Gaza and so on. So I think it's almost exclusively central bank buying, to be honest with you. There's also been some buying from very, very wealthy families in the Middle East and some, to a lesser extent, from wealthy families in Hong Kong, China. But those people tend to have the same kind of motivations as central banks, right? They want a hedge. They're buying for defensive reasons, for insurance. And so in those circumstances, you buy physical gold. You don't buy mining stocks and you don't buy silver, right? You buy physical gold and you are also price agnostic. You know, I always say to people, it's a bit like, if I move house and gosh, this is expensive house insurance. I think I'll wait 6 months till the price comes down. Well, nobody does that, right? So if you want insurance, you might do it because you can't afford it, but you don't take a gamble on where the price of insurance is going to be a year from now. And similarly, if you're a central bank afraid of U.S. weaponization of the dollar, you buy gold now. And so they tend to be price agnostic. So anyway, in answer to your question, I don't think there is a lot of buying from other people. We see blips on geopolitical events, but we don't really see huge moves up. And we don't see, I don't think we see sustained moves up from geopolitical events.
Is the weaponization of the dollar a geopolitical event in itself? Meaning weaponizing the SWIFT system and seizing $300 billion in Russian assets, isn't that a geopolitical event in itself?
You got me there.
No, I'm just thinking out loud more, Adrian, there. Because that's pushing absolutely. Central banks.
I don't think that's something that's going away. That doesn't mean we're going to see consistent central bank buying, net buying month after month after month. But, you know, that's going to be something that's going to still play out a year from now and 2 years from now, in my view.
Hypothetical question, Adrian, and I know we don't have glass balls or anything to sort of forecast the future, but if the U.S. were to seize the $300 billion together with the U.K. and the EU and start spending it on the Ukraine, for example, what would that do to the gold price? And the U.S. dollar in that regard as well.
So what you're saying, spend more money on Ukraine, and you know, there's even people in the U.S. talking about sending
Russia's money on the Ukraine.
Oh, yeah.
So, and the whole rat tail that sort of comes with that. So I'm curious. And again, we're speaking hypothetical so far because they've seized some assets, but they haven't used them or spent it.
If we're just looking at what would the impact on gold be, I mean, the impact on gold would be positive. But again, geopolitical events like that tend to not be long lasting. We saw this with the Russian invasion, of course. Gold had already moved up. And this is often what happens. Gold moves up ahead of an event because of, you know, rumors in the market, anticipation and so on. And then it spiked when Russian troops moved into Ukraine. And then within 3 months, it was back to where it was, you know, before the whole thing had started. And, you know, that's been true of every geopolitical event, frankly, since 1980 with the Iran hostage. The Iran hostage had a big impact on gold, but that was when gold was already in a very sharp up move. But even if you look at something, you know, an event like 9/11, the effect on gold was, which came out of the blue, and you could argue was a very dramatic event, came out of the blue. So the gold price hadn't already anticipated it. And yet within 3 months, you know, we were back to where we were before. So geopolitical events tend not to have a long-lasting effect.
Can I ask you like a timely question? Because you mentioned the PCE numbers earlier, and I'm just looking at the gold price, and you say, well, PCE came in higher than expected. So my assumption went earlier is like, okay, if inflation is higher than expected, maybe they raise rates again, and that should be negative for the gold price. But yet I'm looking at the gold price and we're up only $10, but it's 0.5%. So I'm curious, like, anything else influencing gold today? Like, I know it's a very, like, an hourly discussion.
I wish you hadn't asked me that, because I'm scratching my head over that as well. Okay. That's contrary to the moves we've seen in gold in the last 4 or 5 months, when the PCE or inflation numbers, CPI numbers have come out. A higher number, as you say, suggests that then, especially with all this talk about postponing rate cuts, some people even saying, what about a rate hike? You would have thought today's number would have seen gold down sharply. The fact that it's, I'll tell you what I have noticed, though. I am surprised by today's move. So I'll lay that on the table. I am surprised by today's move. But what I have noticed over the last, say, 3, 4 months, maybe 5 months, is that when we have a higher inflation number and all the chatters about the Fed not cutting for a while, gold goes down. But week by week, month by month, it seems as though gold is having less of a reaction than the month before to that kind of talk. Am I explaining myself properly? So the effect on the gold price of higher inflation seems to be getting less and less as we go through. So that's one factor. But why gold went up today, and of course, when the number came out, it just shot up. You probably saw that at 8:30. It just shot up, 8 or 8:30, whatever it was. I can't really explain that. The only thing I can think of is that the market is saying, you know, the Fed's losing control. The Fed's narrative is not working.
Okay. Let's put a bow around there. Let's move on. You mentioned the generals and the retail investors are not buying gold. I want to explore that a little bit, because based on what we just discussed, the devaluation of the dollar, higher inflation, you should be buying a lot of gold, especially as a retail investor, to protect your portfolio, especially in this bubbly scenario that we're in right now, especially with the S&P 500 hovering at all-time highs here, the AI craze. Shouldn't you be buying gold to sort of protect yourself? And why aren't we seeing that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, sentiment is a huge factor in any kind of market. And sentiment tends to sort of go in these waves. And so when sentiment is as negative as it is right now, nobody feels they need to buy something, and they certainly don't feel they need to buy it now. There's very much, among gold investors, I think there's very much a wait and see attitude. You know, we'll get lower prices, you know, we'll get better prices later if we wait. I don't know. The other factor, of course, is that the broad market is doing so well. You know, if people have money in 401ks, or they've just bought S&P index funds or whatever, you know, they're doing very, very well. And so the need to buy gold doesn't seem as apparent as it would if gold was not doing well. I think if we see the inflation numbers pick up, you know, as I say, 0.4% month on month is sort of an irrelevancy. But if we see that for the next 3 or 4 months, then I think you'll start to see at least individuals start buying coins for protection. Because individuals, retail tends to respond to inflation. They will buy gold when inflation's moving up. Whereas, you know, the most important factors on gold are not necessarily inflation moving. But it's more easy monetary policy that moves gold.
Gotcha.
Go on.
No, go ahead. Like one thing I've noticed, maybe it's too expensive. Like people, $2,000 gold, like just optically too expensive. And we've had guests on that said, well, gold is going to drop to $1,600, $1,700 again, albeit short, like within a short period of time, like just for a short period of time. So is that the discount window they're waiting for example?
I'm not sure that retail people are waiting for that. I don't think so. That might be a factor with, let's say, more sophisticated institutional investors. Because, I mean, if you do, you've probably seen these, people do analysis of the economic environment and where gold, quote, should be. And, you know, if you look at the end of last year, we came off the most rapid, the most aggressive rate hiking cycle in history. It was even more rapid than the cycle of under Paul Volcker. A strong dollar, you know, gold, quote, should be lower. Gold should be 1600, 1650. So when people talk about the disconnect between gold and gold stocks, I have argued up until very recently, although the gold stocks are very undervalued, don't get me wrong, I think you should be buying them, don't get me wrong, but I have argued that gold is the anomaly, not the gold stocks. It's gold that should be lower, not gold stocks that should be higher, in the environment in which we are, or in the environment in which we have been. So I think some those sort of regression analysis and those kind of analysis are much more common among institutional investors than they are among retail investors. So it's possible that people are looking at that. You know, it's on Bloomberg every month, you know, saying, gold should be at 1642, according to our analysis. And so that's got to make people hold off, I would think.
Okay. Adrian, I'm trying to, you mentioned the mining stocks, and you mentioned mining stocks are where they are for a reason right now. While you said gold, based on the economic assumptions there and the environment, which should be lower, yeah. But mining stocks are right where they should be. But in my opinion, sentiment is completely in the gutter in the mining space. And that's even putting it politely. Why is that? Like at $2,000 gold, shouldn't we be trading much higher? Why is sentiment where it is? And what's a potential trigger for upside?
Yeah, that's a big question. I think there is a difference between retail investors and you know, institutional type investors. I mean, there's a lot of factors why the gold stocks are so out of favor right now. And I mean, for institutional investors, you really have to look at it on a longer term basis. You know, if you go back 15 years, 20 years, 25 years, every single mutual fund you looked at had some gold holdings, right? They might be a US growth or a global value or an emerging market or whatever it was, dividends. But every single mutual fund you looked at had some gold holdings. That's not true anymore. Now, why is that not true? I think, you know, generalists typically in any field tend to buy after price moves. They don't come in right at the beginning. And so you saw generalist investors pick up their gold holdings in 2006, 2007, then crash. And then they picked them up again in 2010, 2011. And why does that happen? It happens because when the fund manager, the US value fund manager, goes to his annual meeting with the board, and the board says, I notice you only have 1% in gold. Gold's doing very, very well. Don't you think we should have a little bit more in gold? And so the manager buys more gold, so he doesn't have to answer the question at the next meeting. And it happens in other sectors as well. It happens with technology. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of people today that are being asked, why don't you own any of the Magnificent Seven? You know, get on board with the program, man. And so they bought gold stocks in 2011. Then what happened? You know, within 4 years, if they had held on that long, they lost 86% of their value in the XAU, right? From 2011 to 2015, in the XAU, the 30 largest companies, they lost 86% of their value. Do you think a generalist says, I better double down on this sector. This one looks good to me. No, he says, I've had it with this. Either I don't understand it, or they're all crooks, or liars or whatever, but I just don't understand this sector. I don't want it anymore. And then finally, you know, the good guys of Franco-Nevada persuade them that we're different. Look at our track record. Look at our business model. You know, we are a safe gold stock. And then what happens? You get Panama. I think they've thrown their hands up in the air, frankly. You know, and again, if you only have to look at, say, Newmont, the largest gold mining company in the world, Barrick, the second largest gold mining company in the world. Those two are trading at lower prices than they did in 1996, 30 years ago. They are cheap, lower price than they were 30 years ago. I mean, why would a generalist who doesn't spend all day long following this sector, why would he want to be interested in that kind of market? And so I think that's one big factor. It's going to take, well, I'll tell you what it's going to take. It's going to take higher prices. Again, you see gold at 2,200 and you see Barrick at $30, the generalist is going to start buying again. That's not a knock on generalist because we all do it in sectors we don't really know or follow. You never buy at the bottom. You know, if you're not a technology investor or a biotech investor, you never buy those stocks at the bottom, like me, never. And so that's what's going to take it. It's going to be higher prices. It's going to make them come back, in my view. So that I think is one, you know, the disgust with the sector. Again, you only have to look 2011-12. You remember there was a buying frenzy among the senior companies. They were all going out overpaying for marginal projects. Remember?
Yeah.
Overpaying for marginal projects. Well, within 3 years, they had written off over 75%. Of all of the money that was spent in 2011-12 on acquisitions. I mean, if you're a generalist investor, you say, what is this? This is Mickey Mouse stuff. And now, you know, I would argue we've had lots of changes since then. I think we've got better managements generally. We've got more disciplined managements, for sure. We've got far better balance sheets, for sure. I mean, the XAU is cash positive, net cash positive, which is astonishing in a capital-intensive industry. Now, I know that includes Franco and Wheaton. You know, it includes the royalty companies. But nonetheless, you look at a company like Barrick, which is net positive cash, and this is a capital-intensive industry. So, I mean, I think the companies are in far better shape today than they were 10 years ago. But it takes a while for people who've lost 50%. And remember, they lost 50% on something they didn't even understand. You know, if I buy Royal Gold and it goes down 50%, I understand the company, I understand the market. You know, I might even be happy because I can buy more. But if I lose 50% on, well, I'll say NVIDIA, yeah, I'm gone. I'm not coming back. I'm not scratching my head saying, should I buy more? So I think that's what's happened. Anyway, that's a long-winded, but I think it's helpful to see the mindset of these people. And again, that's not a criticism of the investors.
Yeah. Now, Adrian, you mentioned before we hit the record button that you listened to some of the earnings calls. You went through the earnings of the major mining companies as well.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, like some things you picked up there as well, because margin compression, I think, was a big topic that was discussed in general over the last 24 months or even last 36 months, why the miners have fallen out of favor. Because I believe Newmont still has the same profit margin as it did when gold was at $1,300. So the same sort of margin as back then. And of course, the generalist shrugs its shoulders like, okay, your price has gone up, but your costs have completely exploded as well. Is that something that has been addressed at all in the earnings? And like, what are some of the key things you picked up from that?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I mean, I think each one was a little bit different. Certainly higher costs was an overall theme. Most of the companies, whether it was Newmont or Barrick or, you know, Pan American or Royal or Wheaton, they all had one bad thing in their earnings release. Sometimes it was very bad. Sometimes, frankly, it was something that should have been expected. You look at Royal Gold, for example. They had a great fourth quarter. The fourth quarter was great, but but they missed their annual guidance on production. And Royal is one of those companies that doesn't update their guidance throughout the year. So they give you guidance at the beginning of a year, and that's what they expect to get. Well, when you look at, sorry to get into the weeds a little bit here, but when you look at Royal Gold, if you follow Royal Gold, you know the Peñasquito mine in Mexico, Newmont's Peñasquito mine, one of their largest streams, was shut down for, was it 6 or 7 weeks from a strike? So they missed 6 or 7 weeks of production. This was well advertised in the third quarter and their third quarter results. So, you know, nobody could have paid attention to Royal in even a cursory manner and not known that their production was way down because of Peñasquito. So somehow you miraculously thought it was not going to be, it was not going to affect their annual return, their annual production. Well, of course it did. Another major stream they have is the Pueblo Viejo Barrick's mine in Dominican Republic. The expansion of Pueblo Viejo has been, it's been well advertised in the market, both by Royal, but obviously by Barrick as well. But there's delays in the expansion. They had a conveyor belt problem and they had to reorder parts. And, you know, so there was anyone following the company should not have been surprised that they missed their annual, that they missed their annual guidance because of those two events. And yet, you know, the market didn't like it. Now, Royal Gold is down, I think, at like a 52-week low. It's done better than most stocks this year, but that's just one example. And you can look at a lot. Barrick, you know, Barrick has sort of been in the penalty box for a few years now because it's missed its guidance year after year after year. And I think part of I don't like the whole idea of misses and guidance, frankly, because if I'm going to make $10, I can either tell you I'm going to make nine, make 10, and everyone's happy, or I can tell you I might make 11 and make 10, and everybody's annoyed. But I've still made $10, right? And I think in the mining business, you know, there's, anything that can go wrong will go wrong. And Robert Friedman likes to say that, well, in the mining business, Murphy works overtime. And, you know, the truth is, if you're a company like Barrick or a company like Royal with streams, you've got multiple mines out there. Something is going to go wrong at one of them every single year. I mean, that's just mining for you. Something goes wrong. And I think the problem with a lot of these guidance numbers that people put out is they're looking at what we could do. And how do you account for an unknown that's going to go wrong? I don't know how you account for that. But we know that I can guarantee you that over the next 12 months, something will go wrong at one of Newmont's mines. Don't know which one. I don't know what it's going to be. But, you know, nothing ever runs perfectly in the mining business. But the guidance sort of seems as though it assumes things will work at expectations. Now, having said that, some companies like Barrick, until this year's guidance, has always been optimistic. I think it just reflects the nature of the CEO, Mark Bristow, for whom I have a great deal of respect, by the way. But I mean, he is just a very optimistic person and he gives you this guidance. And even in September, I remember I was at a lunch with him and you know, three or four analysts. And one of the analysts, I won't name her, but one of the analysts, well, I've narrowed it down by saying her, right?
I was going to say that.
Was just hammering him, Mark, why don't you change your annual guidance? You're not going to make it. Look at what you've done in the first three quarters. You're not going to make your guidance. Oh, no, we're going to have a great fourth quarter. Fourth quarter is going to be great. Well, it's not only going to have to be great, Mark. It's going to have to be great by, you know, great squared, if you like. It's going to have to be the best quarter you've ever had in your history. No, we're going to make it. Well, of course, they had a great fourth quarter, but they missed on their guidance. Now, again, nobody who follows Barrick should have been surprised that they missed their annual production guidance. It was sort of baked in the cake back in September after their third quarter results. But when they came out with their production numbers, which was a miss, the stock collapsed. You probably saw that. I don't know. It was down. I don't have the number in front of me. It was down like 14 or 15%. Now, then when they came out with their earnings, their full financials, you know, 3 weeks later, and this is another thing a lot of the companies are doing now, you probably noticed, they come out with their production and their, maybe they give you cost estimates or something. And then 3 weeks later, they come out with the full financials, which if they've got bad news, it kind of gives the market two kicks at the can, right? Well, we've got two chances to knock them down. But when Barrett came out with their full financials, you saw that their cash flow last year was actually up 50%. I mean, it was on balance, it was a pretty good report, I thought. But you know, missing that guidance was what really slammed them. Then you look at a company like Agnigo, I was talking to Amar recently, and he said they're often accused of deliberately being very conservative. You know, we don't think we're conservative. We're certainly not underestimating our guidance just so we can beat it. We're just trying to be realistic with that guidance. But, you know, I mean, I think that reflects, again, that reflects the sort of general, demeanor, if you like, of management. They tend to be a very conservative management. Always have been, even before Amar took over, they've been a very conservative type of management, whereas Barrick has always tended to be much more boastful and aggressive. And so that gets reflected in the guidance that they put out.
Adrian, that was very comprehensive. I really appreciate that because I haven't had that discussion on the channel in a long time about the majors and how they're behaving and what they're looking like. One more thing, if I may, Joey.
The thing on that was, the sentiment now is so bad, but I sort of get the feeling that every time a company says we're going to announce their financials tomorrow, the market is looking for the one bad thing in those financials, right? And there's always one bad thing. Either you missed your fourth quarter or you missed your year or your costs were up or your guidance is down or the delay at the mine is longer than you thought or whatever. There's always one bad thing. And the market seems to be focused on that one bad thing and really punishing the stocks. I think over punishing. So I think some of the declines we've seen, like Barrick would be one example, Royal would be another, you know, Wheaton probably two. I think the reactions have been just grossly overdone. Anyway, sorry.
No, all good. Really appreciate that. It's very insightful, Adrian. But to put a bow around the conversation now on the last topic we discussed here as well, like where do you see opportunity now for the investor? Is it too early to jump into mining stocks or is now the right time? What are your thoughts? And to break down the mining stocks, what subsector would you be looking
at? Okay. No, I'll try to get to both of those two things. And let me just say, any company that I speak of favorably, just assume, and I'll try to say specifically, but just assume that we own them either individually or in the managed accounts or in the fund. It would be weird if I said I really like something, but no, we don't own it. Of course not. I think the first thing to look at is that the gold mining let's step back and look at the whole sector. When the sector turns, as we all know, when the sector turns, it tends to move very dramatically at first, and the returns over a short period can be very, very powerful indeed. So, I mean, again, you look at 76 to 80, gold stocks up 800%. You look at 2001 to 2007, gold stocks quintupled. You look at 2009 to 2011, they quadrupled. You look at 2016, in nine months, the XAU virtually tripled, right? And so when they turn, they can turn very, very rapidly. And apart from the 1970s, when the XAU wasn't around, I'm talking about the XAU, which is only the top 30 stocks. It's not the little stocks that can have even bigger returns. So what I always say to people is, if you want to be interested in this sector, you've got to be invested ahead of those turns. Because when the turns come, you know, when Barrick goes from $14 and change to $19 in 2 weeks, most people, most gold investors who've been sitting around watching it for years say, well, I'll wait for it to come back. You know, people don't, they tend to, that's just a natural inclination of people who follow the market. So I think you need to be invested. So when they move, as I've said, the returns are very, very dramatic. And those kind of moves, frankly, they make up for quite a lot of the losses, you know, by just being patient and waiting. That's the first thing. The second thing I'd say is that the stocks are just remarkably undervalued right now. Remarkably undervalued. You know, as I mentioned earlier, the companies are in far better shape than they were. We talked about margins, but on some of the companies, the margins are not that bad at all. You look at a company that's got an all-in sustaining cost of $12.50. Okay, it's up from $11.50, but at $12.50, they're still making a very strong margin, and cash costs can be $800, $900. So again, the margins are very strong, much more discipline, much more cash on the balance sheet. And the valuations of the gold stocks are lower than the valuations of the S&P, which is an extraordinary, that doesn't often happen. So you look at a company like Agnico, which we do own, it's one of my favorite companies, it's one of the more conservative of the large companies. But Agnico, for example, is trading today at its lowest price to cash flow, other than the last quarter of 2015, its lowest price to cash flow in its history. You look at Barrick. Barrick today is trading at the lowest price to net asset value than it has for 40 years. So is the gold price that low? Is the outlook for gold that bad? I mean, these are, you know, I think grossly distorted kind of valuations. And as, you know, my friend Rick Rule likes to say, I'm sure he didn't invent it, but he likes to say it, you know, don't buy hamburger when the fillet's on sale. And that's sort of my overall approach to building a portfolio right now. I mean, sometimes you look at the gold sector and the seniors are just too expensive. So you have to move down the chain. But right now, the seniors are just ridiculously undervalued. So A, they're undervalued. And the other two things to realize is that when gold turns, it's always the seniors that move first, always. Not only do they move first, but they're more certain to move. So if you bought today Newmont, Barrick, Agnico, Franco, and Wheaton, right? The two largest royalties, the three largest gold mining companies. I can, as close as the SEC will allow me to guarantee anything, I can guarantee, but if gold goes, obviously for the SEC's purposes, I'm not guaranteeing anything. But I can more or less guarantee you that if gold goes to 2150, that portfolio of five majors will be up. There's very little doubt about that. But if I buy Consolidated Moose Pasture and Amalgamated Ajax and whatever, they may or may not be up. So the seniors are A, extraordinarily cheap, B, they're the first to move, and C, they're the more certain to move. That doesn't mean we're putting 100% of our portfolio into the seniors, because I think some of the juniors and the exploration companies, particularly if they have either strong balance sheets or cash flow, and there are some juniors that have cash flow, like Origin, for example, or Mandara, we own both of those, two prospect generator type companies, both of which have a positive free cash flow. I mean, how often do you have exploration companies with positive free cash flow? And Mandara, I should look, sorry, but it's not a large company. Let me just look at the market cap to get it right. I like to get things right.
17 sorry, cents, it's $17 million. I would have guessed 20.
Thank you, got it sooner. What?
I would have guessed 20, but it's 17.7 Canadian.
Well, you're very close. I was going to say 20, but I wanted to look. But I mean, for a company that size to have positive free cash flow, and not an anomaly last year, but you know, the business model gives them positive cash flow. Some of his juniors are just extraordinarily undervalued, very, very cheap. But I'm focused on the ones either with good balance sheets or positive cash flow, sources of revenue, or at the very, very minimum, the kind of companies that you know have access to capital. Like you look at a company like Elemental, for example, which is another company we own, a royalty company. They have access to capital through their 35% shareholder, La Mancha. You know, it's got all the money in the world for anything Elemental wants to do if they like what Elemental wants to do. So they have access to capital. But you've got to have one of those things, cash, cash flow, or access to capital if you're in the juniors.
No, fantastic. Oh, good stuff. Adrian, this was really, really insightful. We do have to wrap it up at this point. We're hitting the 55-minute mark. It's been fantastic. Like,
oh my gosh,
a fantastic conversation. It just went by like this. Like, I didn't even check the time until like 15 minutes in. And I was like, whoa, that's a long one. Really appreciate it. Super insightful. Really, really enjoyed it. Adrian, where can we find more of your work? Where can we follow you?
The best place to look is adrianday.com. And that talks about the newsletter. It also talks about the money management. And obviously, if anyone has any questions, we got an email there. We got a phone number. You know, feel free to call. And Kai, I promise you, next time I'm on, I will have had a haircut. I've had two hair appointments in Puerto Rico, both of which have been canceled. So it's going to happen soon.
Fantastic. No, Adrian, thank you so much. Are we going to see each other in Toronto this week?
I'm definitely there, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Then I'll definitely see you.
Are you set up with your camera and everything?
No. I won't be bringing the camera. I think everybody and their dog's going to be walking around with the camera. So I decided not to.
Okay. Well, I'll look for you.
Fantastic. You'll see me in the investment leaders section there as well. So really looking forward to that.
Oh, yes.
Adrian, thanks so much for your time. I got to jump off. And everybody else, thank you so much for tuning in. This was a hugely insightful conversation. It went on way longer than we had originally planned, but it was great. I really enjoyed it. If you liked the content, if you liked the questions we asked, if you liked our guests, leave a thumbs up, leave a like. We do want to hear from you and to leave comments down below. What mining stocks do you own? Do you own any? Let us know. Really want to hear from you and appreciate your time. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll be back with lots more here on SOAR Financially.